This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, we're talking about self-healing robots and the emotional intelligence of robots. But first, have you noticed that the produce in your grocery store seems to be getting bigger and bigger? Cantaloupes the size of bowling balls, strawberries that barely fit into your palm, and tomatoes tipping the scales at over a pound apiece. Of course, farmers have been crossbreeding crops for centuries to make a bigger and better berry. But what are the genetic tricks behind these oversized fruits in this age of genetic engineering? Well, researchers have pinpointed the genes responsible for this growth in one particular fruit, the beefsteak tomato. Yes, remember that a tomato is a fruit. Their results were published in the journal Nature Genetics. Zach Lipman is an associate professor of plant genetics at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in Cold Spring Harbor, New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Happy to be here, Ira.
Thank you. Your study looked at tomatoes, but I understand that you got your start in growing pumpkins.
That's right.
How did that happen?
Probably since I was 13, I've had a secret, not so secret, I should say, hidden passion for giant pumpkins. Always trying to grow the biggest one I could in town and entered into the local fair. Didn't do too bad, topped out at 609 pounds, but lo and behold, it wasn't going to be so easy to do research on pumpkins, so over the years I switched to tomato.
So do all fruit have this potential for growing to humongous size?
Yeah, there is that potential. I mean, I think there's always a limit in how large you can go, but with what we've found, we find that there's a particular program that could be tweaked in order to allow fruits to get larger than they already are.
Let's talk about the pumpkin, because I understand that at peak growth, a pumpkin can put out 10 to 15 pounds of mass per day. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. So a lot of that has to do with the fact that you're pumping the ground full of water, and there's all this root system there ready to suck up that water and all the nutrients along with it. And that goes straight to a single pumpkin that you leave on a plant that occupies probably a 30 foot by 30 foot space.
Does something go wrong in the plant to make it grow unnaturally that big, even in the tomatoes or the pumpkins or any of the other fruit?
So it's unclear if there's something wrong, and I think wrong might not be the right word, whether there's some genetic change that has allowed that pumpkin to get so large. I think that's probably the case. There's been selection. Basically, backyard gardeners have been selecting for larger and larger pumpkins since the mid-80s, and they've reached a point now where, in combination with being able to manipulate agronomic practices, the fertilizer, the watering regime, that they've been able to maximize pumpkin size up to over 2,000 pounds. And I'm sure that there's definitely a contribution to the genetics in all of this, mm-hmm. and this is classical breeding in its truest sense, I should say conventional breeding.
Mm-hmm. But you're working on understanding what when you make these giant fruit, what are you trying to understand?
So our first interest was actually not in the giant fruit. For a long time, my research group has been interested in flower production in plants. And we've been interested in the basic questions of how a plant transitions from making leaves to making flowers. This happens in almost all our crops. And in order for that to happen, certain genetic changes have to happen in the plant. You have to have a certain number of genes get turned on, a certain number of genes get turned off. And this all happens at the tip of all these shoots in the plant. And this tip is called a meristem. And inside the meristem is a small population of cells that are stem cells. And these stem cells essentially have the potential to become any other type of tissue once they receive the proper endogenous signals that are triggered by environmental cues. And so we've been very interested in these stem cells and their contribution to flower production. And we were working on tomato, asking how we could manipulate flower production genetically. And we were looking for mutants that we would find in the field screening thousands and thousands of plants each year that would give us more than the typical 5 to 7 fruits that you might see on the tomatoes on the vine at the grocery store. And several of the mutants we found were making many more flowers because they were producing many more branches on a structure known as the inflorescence. And the inflorescence is the shoot where flowers are born. And we had these particular mutants with many more flowers, and we noticed that when they set fruits, it was very blatantly clear that there was something else wrong because the fruits were now beefsteak tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And I should mention that the fruit that we started with was a plum tomato.
And so you notice these giant tomatoes being born on these mutant plants.
That's right.
I see a movie going on here. Wasn't there a play about plants?
Right, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
Little House of Horrors, Little Shop of Horrors. But go ahead.
That's right. Yeah, we were pretty safe every time we walked into the field. We made sure we had backups just in case there was an issue there. But, back to the real point, I think what was most exciting is that when we saw these giant tomatoes, we knew that there was something wrong with stem cell production. There was way too many stem cells than is typically occurring in this small group of stem cells at the tip of the plant. And when we looked closely under the microscope, we could see that the stem cell population was much larger than it should have been. And this was a clue that there was something wrong in genes that were controlling stem cell production. And when we got down and dirty in the lab, so to speak, we were able to pinpoint those genes that were mutated. And the ones that were mutated ended up being genes that encoded for particular enzymes, these molecular machines that add sugars to other proteins. And in this case, they were adding sugars to a very small protein, also known as a peptide, a short sequence of 12 building blocks known as amino acids that serve as a signal to tell the meristem and the stem cells to not become too proliferative.
So you found something that sort of wanted to stop it from growing.
That's right.
And so you had one gene that wanted to start it and one gene that wanted to stop it.
That's right, exactly.
And then you come up with a perfect tomato by tweaking those two genes?
So here I think is where we've made some major strides. Is obviously in the case of the mutants, we've really disrupted the system and you end up with a very large beefsteak tomato. But what it tells us is that perhaps this system can be tweaked so that instead of overproliferating stem cells double or triple what they normally are, maybe we just increase stem cell production 10%, 20%. And that little tweak of stem cell production might allow you to have a slightly larger fruit, a predictable way of increasing fruit size without compromising other aspects of growth. Because the truth is, when you make these plants with many more branches and many more flowers and very large fruits, they aren't very productive.
And they're not very tasty either. Why is that?
Yeah, that's a question I always get. It depends on the variety. I mean, there are some beefsteak tomatoes that are tastier than others. And a lot of those that are tasty has to do, of course, with breeding for flavor, but also because a lot of times they really don't produce that many fruits, yet there's a lot of nice leaf structure there, a lot of nice shoots that are making these leaves that are producing the sugars that are now getting distributed to fewer fruits because those flowers don't set fruit as well in a beefsteak variety background. But there are, of course, some beefsteaks that don't taste as well. And in that case, what happens is that you end up with so many sections of these seeds called locules that the organization of those locules is no longer proper. And a lot of the flavor comes from the jelly surrounding the seeds that are within those locules. Mm. And sometimes the beefsteak is just so dramatically large that you end up with more flesh than you do jelly.
Now, do you think you can come up with the perfect tomato?
Yeah, I think maybe if I'm given a large grant from the National Science Foundation that specifically says, give me the best tomato and I can hire maybe an army of 50 people, it's possible. I make that joke, but in fact, I think the answer is that it's very difficult to come up with a perfect tomato. There are so many factors contributing to what helps a plant grow properly and how physiologically all the source sink relationship, that is the sugars that are being made in the leaves, are distributed to the fruits, that it's not as simple as just playing with fruit size by playing with the number of stem cells. But it is one aspect that now we think we're able to understand better and control.
So what's the definition of a fruit?
A fruit is essentially what comes from a flower. Inside the flower, you have several different organs. One of those organs are called carpels, and those carpels are what hold the ovules that when they get pollinated and fertilized, you get seeds. And a fruit is essentially when you're eating the flesh around the seeds, or sometimes the seeds are on the outside of the flesh as you have in a strawberry.
So your genes, you think you could make any super fruit because you're working through the flower there? Could you make a super banana?
The super banana, I think, would probably be more challenging simply because research in banana is very challenging. But, you know, maybe in the future there'll be a way to do this kind of thing in banana where now we can look at and target the specific genes that we found in tomato and use that targeting of those genes to manipulate stem cell production to perhaps increase banana size. But between you and me, I think the banana is right where it needs to be.
I agree with you. What's your favorite fruit to work on? What fruit would you like to work on?
Definitely like to work back on pumpkins.
Yeah?
If I could beat the 2,000 plus mark That would be the highlight of my career.
We actually have a video that we did years ago on how they grow those giant pumpkins for the fall, and it's just amazing for Halloween.
Yeah, it's a remarkable plant, and I have to say, you know, sitting here now having the opportunity to speak to you and the masses about what we do in tomato, it really all just started from me growing a giant pumpkin when I was 13 years old on the side of my house with the help of my father. And I think it's really a testament to just having a passion and an interest in something as odd and as freakish as a giant tomato that can lead to something that I have now, which is this wonderful career in science at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory.
Huh. So did you win anything with that pumpkin?
So that year I took in second place, 609 pounds. Wasn't too bad.
Wow.
But since I've done okay, but I've never got up there with the big guys.
Mm-hmm. I guess you're not being out there in Long Island and the fruit guy, you're not working on potatoes at all.
No. In fact, I do grow quite a bit of my research out at the Cornell Long Island Horticultural Experiment Station in Riverhead, New York. In fact, we just finished planting out there yesterday about 4 acres of tomatoes for this year's experiments. And right next to our field, there's some potatoes. We're not working on the potatoes, but I have lots of conversations with those researchers who are doing work on potato.
What is the are you still doing pumpkins on a side for yourself?
Yeah, so this year I was given the honor of being able to dig up a large portion of my in-laws' backyard, and currently we have 4 plants growing, and we'll see what we get out of it this year. It's mostly for the kids. They like to go there and see that peak of growth of 10 to 15 pounds per day, but secretly or not so secretly, I'm enjoying it as well.
What do you say to kids who are listening who want to get involved in this? How should they start?
Don't be afraid of your passion. Don't let anybody tell you that, you know, this is something that's not cool, not exciting. Go with it. Take it to the next level if you can. Talk to the people. Now it's so easy with social media to get in touch with people and learn more than you can just get from the way it was when I was growing up in an encyclopedia. Hmm. I think the real challenge is just saying, you know, I don't have to be afraid to love what I love.
All right. And you can see Zach Lippman certainly loves what he loves there. And thank you for sharing your enthusiasm and your knowledge with us, Zach.
Happy to be here. Thanks very much.
Good luck on your pumpkins and your tomatoes. Zach Lippman, Associate Professor of Plant Genetics at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, famous Cold Spring Harbor, out in Cold Spring Harbor, New York. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about computer science, talking about robotics. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Plato. This is Science Friday. If you're just joining us, we're about to talk about robotics and some interesting new stuff. If you've ever driven a remote-controlled car or you piloted a drone, you know this feeling. It's zipping along, zooming all over the place. Everything's going well until you accidentally smack it into something, right? Then what happens? You get a propeller or a wheel that breaks off. The darn thing refuses to go any further. It sits there. It lies limp on the floor, sadly spinning its gears, right? We've all been there. Well, those, my friends, are robots of yore. Because new robots, well, when they get hurt, they just dust themselves off, repair themselves, and get moving again. Take, for example, the robot my next guest designed. It's a 6-legged walking robot that looks like a spidery thing. And when one of its legs goes out of commission, it's got the smarts to figure out a whole new way to walk. In just a matter of seconds, it does all this. And it just keeps on going. Spooky? Maybe. Jeff Kloon is an assistant professor of computer science, University of Wyoming in Laramie. He's also director of the Evolving Artificial Intelligence Lab. And he and his colleagues published a paper about that limping robot that heals itself this week in the journal Nature. He joins us from Wyoming Public Radio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That is one spooky video I watched. this robot, you disabled what? You tell us, you disabled some of the legs in the robot?
Sure. So this is work that was led by my excellent colleagues at Pierre and Marie Curie University in France. And the general idea is that robots are going to provide tremendous benefits to society one day, especially if they can do tasks that are too dangerous for humans. For example, in Fukushima, we had to ask humans to volunteer to take a lethal dose of radiation to go in and walk some stairs, open a door, and turn a valve. And that's because robots cannot do those tasks currently. But eventually, we want robots to put out forest fires and find survivors after earthquakes. But we won't be able to realize those benefits if robots give up at the first sign of problems. What we need instead is robots that can soldier on if they have some damage to keep doing the mission we've asked them to do.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you get this robot to fix itself? because it does so in like 30 seconds. It figures out what's wrong, and then what? It goes through some iterations of how it might work?
Sure. So what we did in this work is we gave these robots a simulated childhood, if you will, which allows them to kind of play and figure out different ways to move their body. So if you think about when you were a child or if you watch animals, they play and figure out all these different ways to move their body. For example, when you were a kid, you probably walked around on your tiptoes or walked only on your heels or hopped on one foot. And what happens is that if you become injured, you have all that knowledge and intuition of different ways to move your body that you can try to walk around in a way that doesn't aggravate your injury. Mm-hmm. So if you're in the forest and you have a big gash in your heel, you might say, oh, I know how to walk on my tippy toes. So you pop up on your tippy toes and walk out of the forest. Or if you had a search and rescue person looking for survivors after an earthquake, they might really wrench their knee and not have time to go in and have an MRI and surgery because, you know, seconds matter and lives are on the line. So they would just figure out a new way to walk around and get the job done. And we've basically done the same with robots. In these computer simulations, they are encouraged to play and figure out a whole variety of different ways to move their body. And that allows them to, when they become injured, quickly try a few of the different things that they learned during this simulated childhood to, you know, in a matter of 1 to 2 minutes, find a behavior that still works despite the damage.
And as I say, they do it in a very short, what, a few seconds, 30 seconds, something like that?
Sure, yeah. You could take this robot, step on it, you know, and watch it kind of flail around for about 30 to 120 seconds, and then it would slowly conduct a few experiments, almost like a scientist, and get up and walk away. And it may give you a weird look over your shoulder.
It's just like the movies where you try to kill the robot and it suddenly repairs itself. Right?
Which is exactly what you want to happen if that robot's trying to find you if you're in a collapsed building or if you're inside of a house that's on fire. You want it to keep going despite the fact that it gets injured. But of course, yes, any tool can be used for great good or great evil. And so if your enemy charges this robot to hunt you down, then it's probably not going to be a technology that you're a fan of.
Now, I understand your colleagues in France got a real-life taste of this when they were going to demo the robot for some VIPs.
That's right. It's a funny story. So they had these, you know, VIP scientists visiting the lab, and then so they made sure in the days before the demo that everything was set up and worked properly and that the gait that the robot had learned to use when it has its broken leg worked perfectly. They go to sleep at night, and overnight the university wanted to make the lab look great, so they waxed the floors, which looks spick and span, but actually is tremendously slippery for our robot. So when my scientist friends got there in the morning and they played, you know, ran the gate in front of these VIPs, the robot just slipped and flailed all over the floor. But fortunately, we have an algorithm that can adapt to unforeseen circumstances. So they let it adapt, and the robot, you know, conducted a few experiments, changed the gate subtly, and was up and walking across the lab, you know, in about a minute or two.
When you say that you gave it a simulated childhood and taught it those things that it could do, when it just did what it did and it learned how to fix itself, does that also enter its memory? Is it getting smarter about fixing itself all the time?
So it really behaves a lot like a robot scientist. So what it does is it takes its kind of expectations that it learned from childhood about each one of these different ways to behave and how fast it is. And then now that it finds itself damaged, it starts to conduct experiments. It says, let me try this way of walking, which should perform pretty well based on my childhood. And it tries it out. And if that doesn't work, it kind of updates its expectations for what works and what doesn't in its new damaged body condition. So it not only will rule out that particular behavior, but it will actually rule out all similar types of behaviors, and then it will try something completely different. Try that. If that new thing doesn't work also, it'll rule out that family. It'll try a handful of those, and we found that it almost always finds a very effective gait in about 60 to 120 seconds.
Well, now that you've got this triumph, what add-ons do you now? How do you want to take this robot further?
So one thing that we definitely want to do in the future is apply it to more complex robots and in more challenging environments. So right now we've got a robot that, you know, if you step on it, can get up and keep walking across the lab. But we'd also ultimately like these robots to be out there in the world helping save lives, put out fires, and even also maybe help elderly people in their homes. So there are a tremendous number of people that, you know, are incapacitated due to sickness or age, and they would like to live independent lives, and they don't like the fact that they have to have a human helping them with all of these very routine aspects of their lives. So, you know, we'd ultimately like to see robots in those homes helping those people live on their own very high-quality lives without kind of feeling like they're a burden to somebody. But in that situation, if the robot becomes damaged, you know, our technique would allow it to figure out a way to keep doing the best that it can until the repairman can be called out.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255, talking about the robots. These are self-healing robots. We're going to expand our discussion. You can also send us a tweet at SciFry. I want to expand this discussion about robots. They get smarter. They're getting smarter and smarter. But could they ever master those quintessential human qualities like emotions, ethical thinking? Ashok Goyal is a professor of computer science at the Georgia Institute of Technology, a.k.a. you'll know it as Georgia Tech in Atlanta. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Are you familiar with the robots we're talking about?
Yes, indeed. I read Jeff's article. Jeff, congratulations. That's really cool work.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Being a computer scientist, Ashok, a lot of commentators, Bill Gates, Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, have all expressed their concern that artificial intelligence can go too far. Maybe, look, these robots can repair themselves. Why can't they, you know, become smarter than we are and take over? Do you share that fear?
I certainly understand the concerns. However, I have to say that I don't quite share them. And here is why. First of all, human intelligence has evolved over a very long time. It's not just that you and I as individual humans who are intelligent. You know, our learning, our intelligence, our cognition is a social process. We learn from our peers. We learn from our parents. And what we learn is not just how to become more rational, but we also learn about empathy. We also learn about emotions. We also learn about ethics. Intelligence and emotions and ethics, I think, go together. I don't think one can separate them and say we'll build an intelligent machine which will have no emotions and no ethics. If you do that, I think, Ira, then you can't go very far. That intelligence will be very limited.
So how do you build emotions and feelings into a robot?
That's a good point. So I can take one example, and that's indicative. Of course, that's a very hard question. I don't have a full answer. But consider the emotion of fear. You know, you, Jeff, I, our listeners, all of us have encountered fear at some time or the other in our lives. So I'm lying alone in bed. It's late at night. I suddenly get up from my sleep because I heard a window creak. What happened? I'm suddenly afraid. And that fear now heightens my attention, heightens my senses. All of my resources are now allocated to, is there going to be another sound? Now, this fear then becomes a resource allocation mechanism, part of intelligence. And so similarly, if we can think of robots being fear, because fear in that case means that robots are putting all of their attention, Jeff's robot, for instance, on that particular source that is causing the fear.
Mm-hmm. But you have to then, so it's basically understanding fear as you know fear. Because maybe fear is different for everyone, isn't it?
Now, that's entirely possible. So one aspect of this is that, you know, when AI began about 60 years back, then at that time people thought emotions were really the irrational part of intelligence. We ignored it. AI ignored it. Ethics were not paid much attention either. 60 years later now, AI is being a lot of attention to emotions and to ethics. We don't quite understand emotions from a computational perspective. We don't quite understand the different kind of emotions, different kind of fears. That science is yet to be built.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, a child learns emotions, learns ethics, develops emotional, ethical understandings through years and years. Right? If you're on the dinner table, you learn how to be polite or you learn how to help people. But it takes, almost a whole lifetime to learn these and develop these emotional and ethical values. Can you do it that quickly in a robot over a period of months, days?
I expect that robots, too, will take a long time. My colleagues and I in AI do not think that we're going to have very intelligent robots, human-level intelligence robots, over the next decade or so. We're talking about a process that's going to unfold over generations, maybe centuries. And the robots that Jeff has that are learning how to adapt to changed body parts, the same robots tomorrow might be learning how to adapt to different kind of emotional and ethical situations. And that's going to be a very slow process, just like it's a very slow process for humans. So the chances that, you know, we are going to program a robot that is suddenly going to learn all the emotions or have all the emotions are very slim.
Jeff, jump in on this. What about having emotions in robots?
So I agree with Ashok that one of the big revelations recently in artificial intelligence research is that as opposed to programming things in yourself, it's much better to let these robots or artificial intelligence agents learn on their own how to behave and have experiences in the world. And so it will take, you know, a lot of time for these robots to gain high levels of competency. And in those experiences, they could be learning how to deal with ethical situations and social situations and the like. The one caveat I'd make, though, is that computers are very fast. And so robots could learn that in a simulated lifetime that might happen, you know, in a couple days of our time, as opposed to requiring 14 to 20 years. You know, that we take a typical, you know, youth or, you know, child in our civilization takes to learn these sort of ethical behaviors. So it will require a lot of experience, and it's not at all obvious exactly what kind of ethical norms they might learn, but it could happen much faster, I believe, than Ashok believes. Hmm.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Ashok Goyal and Jeff Kloon about robotics. How important, and this is a tweet that came in, and it's sort of interesting about this aspect. Deidre Kelly says, which will be more challenging to program, ethics or humor? Is it important for a robot to have humor?
You know, it is interesting. Right now, I'm co-chairing a conference on cognitive systems at Georgia Tech, and one of the papers is on humor. In fact, one of the leading scientists in AI said a long time back, about 20, 30 years back, that we will know we have an intelligent machine when it can understand a joke and laugh at it. I think humor is going to turn out to be a fairly complex thing because we don't even understand what human humor right now is. You know, why do you and I laugh at jokes?
Mm-hmm. Is humor part of the Turing test?
It certainly is. The Turing test is wide open. The human interrogator can ask the computer whatever it wants. And if the human interrogator decides to start cracking jokes and seeing how the computer responds, it has to respond in a human-like way to pass the Turing test.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, would you like to put emotions into your robots, or are you working in a different direction?
I think as a field in the long term, we definitely want to go that direction. It's a fascinating field of research, not only because robots might be more capable and effective and responsible if they have ethics and emotions, but also because it teaches us about ourselves. So there's a great quote from Richard Feynman that says, "I cannot understand that which I cannot build." And to some extent, the artificial intelligence field is on a giant quest to understand ourselves and our own humanity and our own consciousness and how we think and see and act in the world. And by building computers, we typically understand ourselves and learn more and more about, for example, how complicated humor is or vision is and many different aspects of society. So I don't have any immediate plans to be working on that research, but I certainly am excited about my colleagues in the field that are working on that.
Our phone number, 844-724-8255. 844-SCI-TALK, if you'd like to call in and talk about the robotics and intelligence. Are there a lot of people trying to get into this field now?
I would say that right now there's an absolute gold rush in artificial intelligence. So about 3 years ago, there were a few advances that really took everybody by surprise, even people within the field. Things that really weren't previously thought possible started becoming routine. And since then, almost by the month, there have been dramatic results that really, really open one's eyes to the possibility and, you know, blow back the hair of even the people working in the field.
Give us an idea of one or two of those things.
Sure. So right now, computers can see the world. You can show them images of things, and they can recognize, that's a car, that's a motorcycle, that's a bike. Even more complicated, they can look at an image and describe it and say, that is a girl in a white dress playing tennis with two men dressed in green behind her. Wow. Or that's a man surfing on a wave in a blue wetsuit. These same exact algorithms that do those tasks can also translate between human languages on the fly. So you can now have a real-time conversation with somebody who speaks Mandarin, if you don't speak a lick of it, while you're speaking in English. And the same technology also could take the sounds I'm uttering from my mouth right now and turn them into words. So on your phone, if you ever use the text, you know, the speech-to-text function, that's using this exact same algorithm. So for decades in artificial intelligence, the holy grail has really been kind of a small set of a small set of algorithms that can do a whole variety of different tasks. And we're now starting to see that work, where the same artificial intelligence techniques are used in a wide variety of applications.
All right, we're going to take a break. This is fascinating. Coming back with us, hopefully you will join us. I'm talking with Jeff Kloon of the University of Wyoming and Ashok Goyal, professor of computer science at Georgia Tech. Our number, 844-724-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about artificial intelligence, the future of robots, this hour with my guests, Jeff Kloon, assistant professor of computer science, University of Wyoming, director of the Evolving Artificial Intelligence Lab, Ashok Goyal, professor of computer science at Georgia Tech. Our number, 844-724-8255. Before we get to the next call, I want to bring up something that people talk about a lot, and that is a lot of focus in the media is on the ethics of machines and robots. But sometimes, a lot of times in science fiction, sometimes, you know, over a beer, you hear people talking about the way humans interact with robots. If we hurt robots, does it matter? That how should we treat the robots? Let me start with you, Jeff.
Sure. So a lot of people actually in the comments on the articles that have been written about our new paper and in the YouTube videos feel like we are cruel and unusual scientists that are torturing these poor robots. And they really, really feel empathy for them. And I think that's a hallmark of the fact that the robots are starting to become more capable and therefore they look more natural. So the robot in our video, when we damage its leg and it learns to limp away, really looks like a crab with a broken leg that's kind of limping away in pain. And that evokes our sympathies. I think currently right now there's no problem at all with this. The robots do not feel any pain. But one of the greatest mysteries in the history of the universe is how we went from molecules to emotions. How, you know, random rocks and atoms and molecules together in living things suddenly produced feelings of, a like for chocolate or sadness or love. And we don't know when that transition happened or at all how it works or why it happens. So just it's anyone's guess whether or not or when artificial intelligence will start to feel emotions in the same way that we do. And, you know, we want to start having conversations about what we should do in that situation, how we can identify when that transition happens, and maybe start setting up laws to protect us from torturing robots in the same way that we don't want to torture animals or humans.
Ashok, your feelings?
Yes, there are two sides to this, Ira. On one side, I think robots will gradually learn ethical values of the same kind that we humans have because they will live with us, they will partner with us. So just like you and I learned that it's useful in a very selfish way, it's very useful to be fair and to cooperate with others because that's how I increase my chances of success. In a similar way in which robots will live amongst us, they will learn that it's useful to be fair and to cooperate. On the other hand, when it comes to how humans will treat us, will treat robots, I expect that most humans will treat robots fairly and properly because of the same kind of ethical values. On the other hand, we also know that there are humans who do not treat fellow humans properly or fairly. So it would not be very surprising if they were not very nice to robots either. So we will need some protections. We will need some mechanisms by which we can respect the rights of robots as they begin to have emotions and ethics.
Let me go to the phones. Our number, 844-724-8255. Santa Rosa, California. Heather, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you very much. I think this is a fascinating conversation, obviously. Very bright people, as you always have on the show. But I think you're solving the less difficult problem. Why should we have robots go in to solve human problems when humans, when they have no consequences to the problem, say Fukushima or forest fires or even elderly family members or elderly community members, we need people to be solving these problems, not to outsource it to robots. And I think it's a much harder problem to tackle to get our humanity to develop in the right way. It's much easier to work with these fascinating programs and materials. And I have a background in computer science, so I think I know a little bit of what I speak, that it's a much easier task, I think, to program a less movable target than it is to work with humans and all of our frailty.
Ashok, you have a comment?
That's a very good point, Heather. I'll go back to something Jeff said a little bit earlier. And that is that, you know, in the old sciences like biology and physics, they were outside us and we could try to understand it, understand physics and biology. But in the new sciences, one way of understanding ourselves, our own emotions, our own ethics is to engineer robots. The more AIs we built into them, the more we understand the majesty and awe that humans are. About how, for example, we have metacognition, we can think about ourselves. That comes because we build these robots that are capable of the same kind of things. So it's not just that we're building intelligent machines. We're doing experiments in order to understand ourselves better.
Hope that answers your question, Heather.
That's a marvelous point, except that it's externalizing a problem that is internal to us. Far better for us to work with ourselves than to create something that is different from us and requires a lot of materials and a lot of laboratories, a lot of education and other things when we have human problems in our communities right now that we could be working with them and learning from them instead of trying.
Don't you think there's a need to save people, for example, from natural disasters and floods, earthquakes, buildings collapse, where you might be able to send a robot in a dangerous spot and get somebody out?
Make it more likely that we might build dangerous buildings if we know we don't have to risk people's lives when they collapse.
Okay. Thanks for your call. I think you got the message across. Where do you think the next breakthrough is going to come in robotics?
Well, Ira, you're putting me in a tough spot here.
It's my job.
Right. Yes, I'm sure it is. So, you know, there is an old saw in computer science, the best way to predict the future is to shape it. So I can share with you how AI is trying to shape the future, and that might be one way of predicting what the future will look like. And that is that machines will become more intelligent, but they'll become more intelligent not just in the sense of sort of raw problem solving or rationality, but they'll become more intelligent because they'll be more ethical, because they'll learn how to have empathy, because they'll be able to interact. They'll partner with you and me. They will live with us. They will have the socialization process. And that is going to be absolutely awesome because that will help us learn about how we live as social beings.
Any final comment, Jeff?
Sure. I just want to think that I think artificial intelligence, robotics, and machine learning has the ability to provide profound benefits to society, to help with many of the issues that the caller raised. So we can have robots that are doing the jobs that we don't want to do, or helping, you know, clean up after natural disasters or toxic spills, and, you know, deal with a lot of situations that humans don't necessarily want to deal with, or would benefit if, you know, somebody could do that work, if the robots could do that work, and humans could focus on greater aspirations, like learning how to play jazz, or being creative, or becoming a robotic scientist and whatnot. So I really think the sky's the limit on the benefits this technology can provide the planet. There are inevitably costs and things that we will have to worry about and deal with, but net-net, I think the benefits are huge.
One last question to you. Does your self-repairing robot algorithms, are they public access? Are they available for people to try out?
Sure. We're academics. We love to give everything away for free. We want people to use this. We've published the software, the data, the techniques, the paper, and we'll answer any questions you have on how to use this technology for your own robots.
There you go. We're crowdsourcing it today. Thank you, gentlemen. Jeff Kloon is Assistant Professor of Computer Science, University of Wyoming, and Director of the Evolving Artificial Intelligence Lab. Ashok Goyal, Professor of Computer Science at Georgia Tech. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
If I told you that you, a human, had one gene in common with something like baker's yeast, would you believe me? What about thousands and thousands of genes? It turns out that yeast and human genes go way, way back. About a billion years ago, we had a common ancestor, and now yeast and humans still share about 4,000 genes in common. You might look at a slice of bread a little differently now, huh? Well, to test out whether or not these common genes are actually still interchangeable, scientists humanized yeast genes. What does that mean exactly? Yeah, I want to know too. So joining me now to explain that research published in the journal Science last week is Edward Marcotte. He's professor of molecular biosciences at the University of Texas at Austin. Welcome to the program, Dr. Marcotte.
Hi, Ira. Thank you for having me.
So you took genes from people and put them in yeast?
That's basically the essence of it, yeah.
And they work? The genes function?
Yeah, so we tried about 400 different genes, and a postdoc in the lab named Ashik Khatru would go through, take yeast, and turn off one of their genes, and we'd take the matched human gene and provide the yeast cells with the DNA and see if the cells could still live using the human DNA instead of their own copy of that gene.
And what were the
and it worked about half the time?
About half the time. What kind of functioning do these genes do?
Yeah, so these are all things that are absolutely critical for the life of the cell, and they're involved in the basic operations of the cell, like copying the DNA and dividing the cell and building important structures in the cell.
I think it's really surprising, certainly when I heard about it, that we go back so far, billions of years ago, to have common ancestry.
It's one of these things that your average person doesn't really think about. And obviously, we look completely different on the outside from a yeast cell. But the key is that we have a lot of the same molecular parts inside our cells. So even though we have legs and livers and arms and all these sort of things that yeast cells don't have, within each of our cells, we have a common toolkit of molecular parts. And that's really what the genes give the instructions to build these parts, and that's what we're swapping.
Do we have useful things that the yeast could do for us, make stuff that our bodies do by sticking the genes in the yeast and having the yeast do it?
Yeah, absolutely. And by now knowing that these particular human genes work in place of the yeast genes, that actually gives us sort of a rich set of tools for biotechnology around those human genes. So, for example, one of those is that not all human genes are equivalent. Some people are born with a mutation in a particular gene, or it gets mutated in the course of, a cancer or something like that. Those genes we don't expect to work the same way in the yeast cell as the normal healthy human gene. So now the yeast can act as little test tubes to study the human gene and the changes to the human gene in the context of a simple organism that grows quickly and we can do lots of tests on.
Mm-hmm. So where do you go from here?
Well, so we've tested about 400 of the critical genes that are essential for the life of the cell. But as you say, it's more than 3,000, nearly 4,000 genes that are shared between humans and yeast. And we're actually gearing up to test many more of these and find many more of these cases. And in doing so, we're setting up for being able to do things like drug screens to find drugs that would manipulate the action of the human genes, and also just understanding a lot more about basic fundamental processes of how evolution operates. Hmm. This measure of swappability gives us a lot of insight into kind of the processes of evolution.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. In case you're joining us, I'm Ira Flatow talking with Edward Marcotte, a professor of molecular biosciences at the University of Texas at Austin, where he swapped in, human genes into yeast and got them working. But you said you only got about half of them working. How come only about half of them were working?
Yeah, so once we figured out which half were working, we could actually go back and ask exactly that question. And a graduate student in the lab looked at more than 100 different properties of the genes. And what we figured out is that it relates to how the genes work together in systems. So genes don't work alone. They work together to build little molecular machines with lots of parts that work together. And essentially, it was those machines that the individual genes would either be swappable or not on a machine-by-machine basis, effectively. So we could see those patterns come out of the data.
Is it possible to engineer some other genes so that they might work better?
Yeah, I think that's entirely possible. And it opens up all sorts of interesting questions. We tested the genes one at a time, but could we put in entire sets that we know individually work and have yeast with, partly human cell process? And that might allow us to look at things like genetic disease as it relates to failures of that process in humans, but using the yeast system as a test bed.
Is there anything better than a yeast to try it out in?
Well, that's a good question. Laboratories around the world are starting to use this strategy in worms and flies and other simplified organisms. So, for example, in a hospital, if you're diagnosed with a tumor and they use genome sequencing technologies to figure out which mutations you have in that tumor, it might be one day possible to put those into a worm or a fly to figure out which drug cocktail would be the most effective on it.
Mm-hmm. Which are there any human genes that work the best right now and seem like great candidates for moving forward to a next step?
Well, so one in particular is the entire cholesterol synthesis pathway. So you think of cholesterol as something you eat in your diet, but actually Right. Your cells make it all the time as a healthy part of the cells to give them the right structure. And out of the 19 genes we looked at, 17 of them were fully swappable between the two. So to a first approximation, humans and yeast have pretty much the same cholesterol synthesis machinery that dates back to a billion years ago, to the last common ancestor, and is basically unchanged between the species.
Could put them on a low-fat diet? Or
You could indeed, yeah. Right.
Would you do something like check out new drugs, cholesterol-altering drugs on the yeast?
Yeah, and in fact, many of the cholesterol-altering drugs that we have right now people take statin drugs and so on, originally came from fungus.
From a fungus?
Yeah, so a lot of the available drugs are natural products that came from microorganisms or something like that. And in the case of cholesterol, that's an important source of some of the early statins.
Mm-hmm. So how soon do we see the fruits of your research?
Well, it's basic science, and it takes a while to get mm-hmm. these things moving. We've been able to move pieces of it further ahead than others, and a few years ago, we actually managed to discover that an antifungal drug was actually affected blood vessel growth in humans, even though that hadn't been appreciated before. So even with current drugs tested against these humanized yeast, I think we'll be able to start seeing some connections soon. But it's science. You can never predict exactly what's going to happen as you move forward.
Yeah. Won't be looking at our pizza or loaf of bread quite the same way.
Well, maybe as a family reunion instead of a diet.
it's all around the dinner table. All right. Thank you, Dr. Marcotte. That's fascinating, for taking time to be with us today.
It was my pleasure.
Edward Marcotte is professor of molecular biosciences at the University of Texas at Austin. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Reminder, we still have time to help out our science club explain the sun. Yeah, visit sciencefriday.com/scienceclub for details. And for the kitchen geeks in you, we have a final sun activity. If you're up to it, you can go into your kitchen and model the convection that occurs on the surface of the sun. You can model it in cute little things you can do with your kids in the kitchen. You can check that out at sciencefriday.com/convection. And we want you to help create a human sundial. Oh, this is a great project. Go to sciencefriday.com/human sundial and listen in next Friday when our science club reconvenes to explain the sun. We're going to crowdsource the human sundial at sciencefriday.com/human sundial. Have a great week. If you're out in the sun, put on some, sunblocker while you're doing that sundial. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.